when you go and visit someone and you've tended to the relationship every few months for 7 years, you actually return to a past version of yourself. And there's a lot of value in maintaining that connection, because they know a version of you that 5 years down the line, no one can meet.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to Strolling. In this extended episode, I'm speaking with Nathan Hewitt, who's known for building collective resources through nonprofits. I wanted to record with him simply because it feels good when we chat, and I enjoy his way of being present. He was really open to discuss so many topics with me. We ended up jumping between technology, people, money, friendship, leaving social media, food, death, emotions, dialogue, and even more. Basically all the stuff I find fascinating. I see in Nathan someone who tries to live their values and move towards the world they want to live in. And I appreciate how he ties together different domains to achieve collective goals. Definitely an inspiration for me. Hope you'll enjoy our cozy hangout. Let's get into it.
Do I sound like I'm in pain?
It sounds like you've definitely studied music.
Anyone have any beta blockers?
No. Yeah. I don't know why I find it surprising that you found me from this Mastodon instance, because it's kind of like tech-oriented and like, I don't know. I like chatting with you, and I feel like I like the vibe, and I wouldn't expect to meet somebody with this kind of vibe on that place. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, I look at what other people post there, and it's absolutely completely different from anything I've ever posted or would post. And so we met on a Mastodon instance with a bunch of people that are kind of like low-tech people, or like sometimes retro computing people, and sometimes they live on sailboats, and sometimes they travel the world, and I don't know, but kind of tech-oriented, and, you know, I'm not a coder, so...
Oh, you're not? Okay.
I'm not a coder, yeah, maybe.
Okay, somehow I didn't get that part, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I know just enough to know what a coder, you know, or engineer, or whatever they prefer to call themselves, is generally talking about.
Oh, okay. And you also... Like, I feel like you have this tech awareness about, like, what platforms are doing and, obviously, like, how to use stuff and, like, you're involved with newer technologies. But if you're not a coder, do you also consider yourself, like, not a tech person, whatever that means?
I don't really know what a tech person means.
Okay. Do you use those words to describe yourself?
I tell people that, I don't know, my family probably thinks I'm a tech person.
Okay.
You know, because my dad's asking me for help.
They call you to solve the problems.
Yeah, call me to solve the problems. But I've always identified as a nonprofit worker or an activist or a musician before I would identify as a tech person.
Huh.
Because the ways I know tech are in service of those other things. It's not for its own purpose.
Hmm.
It's never been for its own purpose.
Any striking example for you where you've used tech for some other purpose? Maybe perhaps one that doesn't get talked about very often.
I don't know about ones that get talked about or don't get talked about, but I mean, examples that come to mind are I've been involved in using technology at work in the office, and I've been involved, or one other way that I've gotten really into it is making a personal website.
Okay.
And hosting the website myself. And so for someone who knows a couple computer languages, that's trivial.
Yeah,
I was for someone who is not technical at all, it's like wait, what's Bash?
Yeah, I would say even like to say that you're not a coder, you're not a programmer, but to like host your own site, whatever. Like, do you mean on your own server, or do you mean
like a virtual private server?
Okay, yeah, I mean that's actually
on my own server one time. Yeah.
Okay. Like, that's more than I was comfortable with, like, a few years ago. And, like, now I'm comfortable with, like, virtual private server, VPS, whatever. But, like, yeah, I think that's interesting if you say that you're not a coder and you're kind of doing that kind of stuff.
So. Yeah. Well, I mean, I know this. A lot of people do this, but I Google every single thing I do.
Oh, wow.
In terms of coding or what have you. In terms of technology. It's like, how do I do this specific thing? And I guess you have to have some sense of what's possible to do that.
Uh-huh.
And people think I'm good at spreadsheets, too. but I Google every single time I'm looking for a formula. I'm like, I need a formula that adds or subtracts dates from one another, you know, and then I just find it. Yeah. So it's, it doesn't, I don't feel like I come in as some sort of subject matter expert on any of these things.
Yeah, it's reminding me of this kind of phenomenon that's often portrayed in movies where, like, the guy's going on a date and there's, like, a bug in his ear and somebody's whispering him, like, what to say to the other person. And you know, maybe it works and the person thinks he's good at what he's doing or whatever. Actually, it doesn't have to be dating. It could be anything. Like, just to seem like you know what you're doing, but you're getting the information from somewhere else and it's just happening fast enough, you know? Mm-hmm. And in your case, you're saying people think you're good at Excel or whatever and it's, and you're just like, well, I'm just Googling everything.
I'm just Googling it. You know? And if anyone ever asks me, that's exactly what I tell them.
Exactly, right.
So it's not a secret.
Yeah.
If I went to the date, I would tell them, hey, by the way,
I've got
a bug in my ear just to help me out and make sure I give you the right answers.
Radical transparency.
Yeah, that's right.
Amazing. Yeah, and where I was going with this is, like, I think in the future, actually, we're all hoping that some kind of AI, sentient being will just give us answers and we'll be able to look smart or, like, we'll be able to speak a language that we don't really speak and it'll be somehow communicated and then... How many of us are going to be transparent about that? You'd be like, oh yeah, no, I just got that from ChatGPT. I don't actually know.
You're going to add the dates are going to be inside like a Faraday tent. Faraday tent? How do you say it?
What does that mean?
Okay, the signal blocking tent.
Okay.
I've never actually said Faraday.
A true test of your humanity.
Yeah,
can you have a conversation?
Yeah, can you have a conversation tent? In a Faraday tent? Whatever. It's like, they're kind of shiny, isn't it? This might be misinformation, okay? But I think in my head, these things are like, the material is kind of like shiny.
Right.
So it's a bit futuristic, kind of cyberpunk, you know, bar where you go inside. You don't have to leave your phone at the door because the phone's inside your head.
Right.
And you just
but that's the thing,
walk
right?
into it's the not, protected
you,
space.
You won't need the signal at that point because it'll be locally hosted in your own fingers or something. Yeah. And then you just get it. You don't need the internet connection to have the AI tell you what to say. Anyway, that's just funny. Anyway, you have this angle with, like, I don't know, counter technology or something, or, like, not so into it, but you're into it and you're kind of aware of things. And, like, I remember you talking about how you left social media. And I don't know if this is something specific. Like, I think people who are also not programmers or connected with technology do that also. Like, they just kind of leave social media. But maybe sometimes it's for, like, social reasons. It's like, oh, I can't. It's just too many notifications or whatever. Mm-hmm. What did you do, and, like, what were your reasons?
It was two-pronged. There was this aspect. There was this kind of social mental health reason. Absolutely, I felt that I felt like I was kind of addicted to logging on.
Mm.
You know,
You mentioned scrolling. Also, you like to scroll.
Yeah, yeah. It was reflexive. It almost didn't matter what I was looking at. I just wanted to be occupied by something. My mind to be occupied by something. I would get little boosts from different kinds of notifications. I would post something, and then I'd be waiting for the likes, waiting for the comments. And if they came, I would get a boost each time, and I would keep checking. Mm-hmm. And then whenever they stopped, I'd be like, oh man, they stopped.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter how many there were or how few there were. At the point when it stopped, I was sad that it stopped.
Yeah.
I don't know what the definition of addiction is, but, like, that is, like, I'm just going back for more over and over again.
Okay.
And
I relate to that anyway. I mean, I don't know if I'd use the word sad, but it's more like, oh man, it's done. And maybe I have to figure out another thing or something.
Yeah, you got to replace it. You got to get another one going. And if there were no likes, I'd be kind of downtrodden about it. And, you know, I'd be like, man, even though I knew that it was all mediated by algorithms or by clicks, I'd be like, dang, I need to game the system a bit better next time.
How do I win next time?
That type of thing. So there's that angle, a lot of comparison to other people, and just feeling like it was eating up my life also. Like, hours of my life were being pulled into this thing that did not serve me, didn't serve my relationships. You know, it makes you... It helps you actually maintain weak ties. It doesn't really help you maintain strong ties. And I felt like I was spending too much effort on these weak ties.
When you say it, you're referring to...
Oh, sorry. Facebook, Instagram, not TikTok. TikTok's different, but and Twitter, depending on how you use it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was Facebook, though. Yeah, to be explicit, and it was all about these social connections, maintaining the weak social connections, and also following, getting entertained by different things I was following, and I wanted to focus on the people I cared about most and be like really explicit about who those, like with myself, about who those people were, right. And spend less time, not zero time, but spend less time connecting with people that mattered less or that I was less connected with at that point in my life. The second prong was my philosophical or ideological feelings about surveillance capitalism, broadly speaking, having discomfort with the fact that the advertisements were being targeted to me and that I was being slowly, minutely influenced to act in a way that was, that someone was paying Facebook to get me to act. Bit by bit by bit, small bit by small bit, like they're paying to have Facebook influence me in particular directions. And I had discomfort around that, and also around the way that people's data was being used.
Discomfort because you feel controlled, or you feel like you don't want to be influenced in any way?
Certainly, I don't want to be controlled or influenced by something like that. Mm. We're always being controlled or influenced, but I didn't want to be controlled or influenced by that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, where would you draw the line? And so that is something you don't want because it's commercial in nature? Or because
I would say I'm generally kind of like, I don't like seeing advertising.
Okay.
Yeah, you can say I'm anti-advertising. Okay. I'm a little bit anti-marketing in general.
Controversial.
Is that controversial?
Anti-marketing.
Anti-marketing? Look, here's the thing about marketing. If it's not bullshit, it's not marketing. It's all marketing is bullshit. And
you're breaking
marketing
my heart.
Marketing people will tell you that. They will tell you. They'll agree. They're like, yes, we make up this stuff to make whatever is in front of us, it doesn't matter what it is, we make it look good. Yeah.
That's an aspect of it, yeah. I kind of think there are, of course, marketing is kind of huge. I don't know if it's really, I mean, there is the kind of like, you know, selling cigarettes by like having an idea about what it is to be cool or desirable or something. And then there's like, or selling iPhones or whatever. And then maybe there's this marketing where you're like, this is how what we're offering can help you in some way. And maybe that's also just,
it's fine. It's fine. I'm going beyond like what I would actually accept with that statement, but right. Even good things, healthy things are marketed, yeah. And the way that they're marketed, it's not like, hi, this app is called blah blah blah, it costs this much per month, and here are the at things that it does. No, it says this app is gonna change your life.
Okay, right.
And that's bullshit.
So it's hyperbole.
Yeah. It's hyperbole.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. Fine. So you don't want to be controlled, you don't want to be influenced, and so what you have your reasons and you stopped using Facebook, or you deactivated or you deleted?
I deleted Facebook and Instagram, which were the ones that I had at the time.
Okay.
And I didn't use Twitter, so
Nothing lost.
I am still on LinkedIn to my eternal regret.
That's the one I've never gotten on. Yeah.
Good for you. There still is kind of a perceived economic impact for me of leaving.
Hmm. Of leaving.
LinkedIn. Of leaving LinkedIn.
Right.
That's why I haven't left.
You don't leave it.
Because I have a career and I'm maintaining it for better or for worse.
And what about the impact on your social life? I guess you were saying that it's mostly for weak ties, Facebook and Instagram. And so, how did you feel when you just deleted your account? Like, what was there some impact in your social life?
It was a little bit less clear in the short term because it was in the middle of lockdown, COVID lockdown.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And so...
what a time.
Yeah. I was already like, you're not seeing people in person. And then soon after I moved and went through a breakup, and like there were also kind of big social changes. There was this period of change. And so it's a little bit hard to know exactly how it had an effect. What I would say is I've had to become a lot more intentional myself about reaching out to people. I've had to give up on I know others have this complex sometimes, this feeling that they reach out, and then the next time they're kind of waiting for the other person to reach out. People who do this.
Oh, it's keeping track.
Kind of like keeping track, keeping score a little bit. And of course, I've had to absolutely let go of that. I reach out, and I'll reach out again, and I don't care. Wow. I don't feel any sort of way.
Interesting. Where do you, so you wouldn't, there's no point where you're going to be like, I've tried so many times, but this person seems like they're not interested.
Oh, well, if they're not interested, that's...
Sorry, not interested, not by saying, I mean, I don't know how they would say this, but like a lot of people would take a non-response as like, okay, this person's like not interested in the current moment or whatever.
I'm actually not talking about following up on a non-response, but some folks will be like, or maybe I'll just say me in the past. Sometimes I would be like, oh, I've initiated our hangout 3 times in a row.
Right.
Are they just kind of saying yes? Like, do they actually want to?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to take the initiative? And that was never healthy, but now I will just, certainly a non-response or like a feeling that the person didn't want to hang out, that's not something I'll like push past or not very far past. You know? But I'm talking about like just taking the initiative in my relationships without some sort of feeling that I expect something else from them.
Mm.
I'm not saying I don't listen for signals that they want to stop or are ready to move on, but I'm saying that if I'm getting the signals that they're feeling connected, then I'll maintain the connection because I'm not going to see their post on Instagram or Facebook that says I had a baby or I'm in New Zealand. You know, I'm going to have to ask them, hey, what's going on in your life?
And you do that?
I do that.
Hmm.
Yeah. I do keep a list. I keep a list of people that I want to check in on.
Cool. Know?
Yeah. I'll admit I haven't really been good at it since the beginning of the calendar year. But in general, I do have a list
that I can go back to. It's something that I was also toying with, not with like the set of my most meaningful friends, because like I think those people I just tend to keep in touch with anyway somehow. And then it was more like I got sold on this idea of just making sure to reach out to like all kinds of people that you might know at least like once a year, and then some people it would be like every 4 months. Like there was some system that somebody was saying, and like I've since let go of a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just think that's interesting that you did it that way. And so are you still doing it this way?
Yeah, though a little bit less religiously than when I started.
Yeah, okay.
And then I do have a way to keep in touch with, like a baseline way to keep in touch with people, which is I have a quarterly newsletter.
Oh, okay.
Which I was going to invite you to.
Please,
yeah.
No, that'd be cool.
Before you departed, yeah.
Where, because I feel like I never saw that published anywhere.
No, because it's personal.
Man, that's amazing.
It's personal. So it's more personal than the website. Like the website I have is like somewhat personal, right? But it's also a little bit professional. Huh. But the personal newsletter is like, I was in this place at this time. Yeah. I was in this place at that time. It's like a true life update. It's 200 people from my personal life.
Wow.
And yeah, there's some professional updates mixed in, or like if I post music or if I post a blog post, that'll appear there. But then, yeah, it's quarterly. It's on the solstices and the equinoxes, beginning of each season.
Do you have an archived past versions?
Yeah. I haven't tested this. I think once you're a subscriber, you can see. I certainly can see.
I will test this.
Test it.
Because I want to see how you did this. Because I think that's fascinating. And I mean, I've tried different kinds of newsletters.
Some are a little bit emotional.
Yeah.
You can see ones that were after tough times.
Yeah.
I didn't hide because it's personal. It's not like a blog post or something.
Yeah. Just to go, man, I should write this down because there's 2 things I want to say. Okay, wait, I'm going to write it before
write it
I
down.
Say it,
because
I can't
good.
Think
you're
of
good.
It. Okay, so the first thing was just to go back a little bit.
Yeah.
When you say you initiate multiple times, or you're comfortable now with always initiating, like, do you feel you need a certain kind of confidence to do that, or any kind of, I don't know how to say, like, something about me says that this is not what occurs to most people. I really have to question why I say most people all the time, but it's just my way of speaking. I think you understand.
What, the people you've talked to, the people, the norm that you're familiar with.
I've engaged with. Like, I feel like I'm sensitive when someone else is doing that work, and I'm and I might try to, like, even without them asking, I might be like, hey, look, why don't I try and set up this time, you know, so it's like a natural reflex for me. But I get the sense that if I tried a couple times, sometimes, like, maybe I felt the same way that you did, where, like, oh man, it's always me. And, like, or maybe,
here's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Someone said this to me, and I was like, I think that's true. People just are mostly thinking about themselves. People are almost always thinking about themselves. This comes up in different situations, like, when you're getting in your head about, like, oh, this thing that I said to someone, did they read into it this way or that way? Sometimes they did, but a lot of the time, they're not thinking about you. They're thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
Their self. There's that angle, but I think also, it's just my feeling that a lot of people are less organized and less purposeful about their relationships than I am at times. Not that I'm always like this. But when I'm on it, and when I decide, like, oh yeah, it's time for me to kind of check in on some of these, I'll do it. And people respond like, hey Nathan, great to hear from you. Like, what's up? What are you doing? I've been meaning out to reach out to you. I was just thinking about you.
Right.
You know, these types of things. And whether or not they were actually thinking about me, you can put in the work and maintain relationships, and those relationships will last for a long time. And one of the things that I found is that then when you return to them, like when you go and visit someone and you've tended to the relationship every few months for 7 years, you actually return to a past version of yourself. And there's a lot of value in maintaining that connection, because they know a version of you that 5 years down the line, no one can meet.
Well, yeah.
And, like, being able to return to that is, like, actually very special. You can kind of bring some of it back with you, this earlier version of yourself, that they know that no one else could meet.
Why do you say that you meet that version of yourself? Or maybe I should just say what I'm thinking first, which is, like, I've thought about this from the point of view that it's really helpful, beautiful, when people see different versions of you, when people see... Mm-hmm. your evolution, and they've been a part of your life at different stages, and I feel like automatically that creates a kind of appreciation for not necessarily a specific version of you, but like hopefully, you know, if you're still friends, then it's like they still see that there's value in the connection, and it's like it tastes better somehow, mm-hmm. because it's been steeping longer.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the way that's just how
it's rich.
Sure. I call it that way. But when I think about it that way or in those terms, I often think that old version of myself is not there anymore, or I don't see it. I wouldn't be confronted with it. But what you're saying is kind of the opposite, which is that you get to confront it. So in which way do you feel like you're confronting that?
I don't know. There was one time I visited someone, and we hadn't spent an extended period together in 10 years. And we hadn't had a phone call, but we had spent our whole childhood together. And just being in the same space as them, and what they say, what they ask, maybe like shared memories. I just had this sense with that one, as much as any other, that I... because I went and visited a bunch of friends a couple of years ago. I had this sense that I was learning about my past self again. And I could kind of like step into it a little bit.
Mm.
At the same time, I was kind of updating her on like what my life is like now and things like that. But I did feel like I was enriching my own understanding of myself in some way.
Another thing that I wanted to pull out of what you said is more like an observation I have about you, just from speaking with you in the last few days, and just what you were when you were talking about not holding back when you're writing your newsletter. I have this sense that you're kind of either comfortable with or like not afraid of dealing with emotions or like working with them in yourself and with other people? Like you were recounting some experience with someone at work and there was some misunderstanding or some kind of miscommunication on your part, or there was whatever, and it's like, and somebody felt bad and just working through it together. And it seems you're very like, just, it seems like you're calm about it, and you're maybe not that you know what to do, but like you're just, you seem comfortable. I want to use this word. Do you see yourself that way?
I suppose, but you're comfortable with your emotions until you're not. And then all of a sudden, you know, I think that I try to be. I grew up really deeply in religion and in Christianity, and I'm no longer part of that faith, but I think I was lucky to be around people and in a place, in a situation where there's a lot of sharing about emotions and a lot of openness. I was never in, well, I don't know about never. I was not as much in situations where there was this kind of masculinity where you have to hide your emotions.
Okay, strong man doesn't cry, or...
Yeah, this type of thing. I didn't encounter that so much. I've been trying also to really dig into my own emotions and to be a good listener to the emotions of others. You're learning, you know, if you can learn from each time you have a, for example, with conflict, or each time you have something really good happen, you can learn. And that's why I was able to say to you, like, I made an interpersonal mistake today. I sound a little bit like a robot, but like, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm a little down, I made an interpersonal mistake, and now we have to move towards repair. And
yeah, even this language, this is kind of why I'm saying this, because like I don't hear this being expressed in that way. And it, for me, it reflects either like an awareness or like it's just so like matter of fact. It's like, oh yeah, this happened, you know. It's not like, oh my god, I did this, and it's like you're breaking yourself down in the process of even just expressing what you're doing. I mean, that can happen also, and that's fine. It's just I think it's interesting to feel like you can work with it so easily, you know. And but maybe it's not easy, you're saying.
I don't know. We all are shaped by our environments.
Yeah.
And that's at every level, like big decisions all the way down to small decisions. And so I feel that, like, I'm not saying people shouldn't take responsibility for what they've done, but I mean that people, at the same time, you don't have to pull yourself apart just because you made some sort of mistake, or just because things didn't go the way that you wanted them to go.
Sure. Where do you get the tools to think this way or to do that?
I don't have some sort of particular book or podcast or teacher or anything like that. I could list every single thing I've ever read or watched. I could talk about my dad or my mom. I mean, really, like, I guess I didn't learn how to talk this way from my parents, but I learned about life from my parents, and they have a lot. They have very deep openness. I don't know what that's, deep openness, I don't know what that means, but they're just so generous, and they're very gracious with the way that they'll listen to you. They would always hear about something that I had done or something that was not quite right, and they would actually just listen to it, and then they would say something back. And to be listened to, and to then be able to kind of process something with someone else, you learn to do that with yourself. To be gentle with yourself. Because that's how I feel like I had to be this morning. I had to be gentle with myself. That, like, okay, that was a mistake, but mistakes happen, and there's only one thing to do, which is, like, to, well, maybe take a breather, but then communicate, do something else, to try and fix it. So I don't know, but where do you learn? I don't fucking know.
It's okay. Yeah. Just
sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. Also, I think that's actually quite beautiful that you say what you said about your parents also, and I feel like I feel that gentleness at least, or that sort of openness, like a capacity to listen. It's a quality I perceive from you, and I enjoy that. So it's part of the reason why I want to talk to you. If I could also just poke on another thing here, which is like just the newsletter saying that you're not afraid to hold back. Like here again, it's a kind of like not being afraid to be. Actually, it's not public really, but in a sense, vulnerable in front of a large group of people and writing out maybe feelings and stuff, and like I don't know.
I feel that it encourages other people to do the same, and I think that it's not healthy to keep things bottled up.
Right.
And I think that if some of what I've learned about that and about gentleness and vulnerability has been from reading the vulnerable writing of other people. And so I can do the same. Say like, oh, this really saddened me that this happened. It's simple. It's actually not anything super profound, but people don't always want to talk about it. And talking about it invites other people to talk about it. It's like when you, there's like a group of friends and first one person's in therapy, then another person, then another person. Or you know, it just kind of says, it's okay to seek out some sort of help. And whether it's therapy or it's something else, whether it's, maybe it's yoga, maybe it's whatever it is for someone.
Would you mind sharing your perspective about $75 hats?
We should set the scene.
I'm not sure what the best way is.
No, here, I'll set the scene. Okay. Rosano's here. We're in Ridgewood, New York. We're just walking. We're kind of ambling along.
Sorry, Ridgewood, does people know that? So Ridgewood is like Brooklyn, Queens area?
Brooklyn, Queens border.
Okay.
We're not going any particular place. But we walk past this store, and it catches your eye very briefly.
Yeah.
It says, I don't remember what it says on the door.
Red letters, and like, it looks like it's been painted from the 1970s or something. Like, it's kind of old retro style decorations and signage, and even like the products in there, like it looks kind of like super old-fashioned, but obviously very shiny and like from last year.
Yeah. And it's a new store. I knew it was there. I'd seen it before. We kind of kept walking, and I can't remember what I said about it, but I was just kind of laughing at it. It's like, oh yeah, you can get some fancy jeans in there or something. But then I was like, wait, can we turn around?
I looked in and I was like, okay, I know what this is. I don't need to know. And then you were like, wait, can I look in and just see the price of some things? And I was like, yeah.
And so we went in and I wanted to confirm for myself that the prices were ridiculous. And it was. We just went and looked at, there was a denim hat, like a little cap, and it was $75. And I said, okay, we can go. But here's the thing. It's gentrification is very complicated.
Yeah.
And I'm not someone who goes around yelling at gentrifiers, because I usually am one.
Right.
And I think I am one in this case, depending on how you use the word. It's radiating outward from lower Manhattan, and it's starting to reach where I live. The $75 hat shops, the wine bars, all of these things are just signals to something that's not so easy to see, which is that the rent prices are going up.
Hmm.
And I like to make fun of the $75 hats and the $100 dungarees or whatever it might be, because my grandparents were farmers and I've seen the real version.
Right.
And it's kind of like this pseudo blue collar stuff. You know, I flinch sometimes when I see some of these.
Yeah, I'll never forget what you said. You're like, it's trying to allow people to present as blue collar, but with prices that could never be afforded by a blue collar person.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're using your grandparents as a reference because you're saying they were farmers, or
yeah. And to be clear, I grew up in the suburbs, but they wore those clothes because they were hardy, lasted a long time, and also they were cheap, and they were kind of also maybe just what was worn at the time. And they still wear them today because they're hardy. They can handle a little bit of work. They've got the double layers on the knees. They've got all these things that are now kind of like fashionable. These things will eventually be not fashionable again. And farm workers will still be wearing them. But the but I just laugh at it because we're also in the middle of New York City. So there's just like other places you could look at someone and be like, oh, maybe they work on a farm.
Right.
Here, there's just, you know, there's no chance.
It's like they're buying new clothes to look like they work on a farm or something of this nature, to maybe rural connected or...
I don't know exactly how these things flow and shift, come into fashion or out of fashion. I'm sure someone's written some analysis of... I think there's probably some political connection where people want to, who are liberal and want to kind of be pro-union, want to be kind of aligned with the working class, can start trying to look like it.
Just
maybe they listen to some indie rock music that's got a bit of Americana mixed in. Maybe they purchased a lap guitar, a pedal steel, just to play around with for a little bit, play some of their favorite tunes. Okay. But I'll stop eviscerating them. Many of them are my friends. it's fashion. It's how it works. But for me, when I went in and looked at the dollar sign, I already knew what it was, but I wanted to kind of just really confirm and get a sense of what was going on.
I think part of the reason why I felt good just observing that when it happened is that it sort of like it confirms my own biases in a way of like just like, oh yeah, I don't like this either and I don't know how to say it. And I mean I don't want to necessarily judge the people. Like, I think people can just do what they want.
Yeah,
right?
Like they can. It's true.
I've said this before about like hipster stuff, that it's kind of everywhere, and I don't mind if people have their corner and they do stuff, but I get worried when it's like everywhere and then I feel like everybody's supposed to or should be participating in that, and otherwise they're not sort of acceptable in certain ways, which is a thing that I've felt in, for example, Toronto, where I was. Like, it's just kind of overtaking the aesthetic everywhere, and at least in the time that I was there, maybe now it's different or worse, but like I didn't like that because I didn't feel welcome, or I didn't feel like, you know, I would, in the neighborhood that I was living in, where you would find these third wave coffee shops and things like this, I would just go in wearing like what I'm wearing now, which is like simple black t-shirt and some pants, and people would like kind of stare at me as if like, well, where's your checkered shirt? And why isn't your hair off to one side or something like this? I've enjoyed our explorations about language and soft language, and you have a way of maneuvering around things with language, and we've talked about it in terms of politics, and you were also talking about work, the sort of like framing things as opportunities instead of issues.
Oh yeah. Or
politics, like I don't know, I mean, what it's like, you don't consider yourself, you know, I was kind of explaining those things to another person because I kind of tend to do them, or I'm working on them, and I'm trying to like find ways to communicate with people that doesn't like set their alarms off or something, as like, you know.
Well, you said you were following this person.
Yeah, there's the person that, there's Bo that I'm following, and I talk to him about everybody. But the funny thing is, like, I've been perhaps following him for so long that I'm already kind of practicing and doing some things, and it's coming out. And this person said to me, it's like, oh, you're such a politician, you know, you're so diplomatic, you're so like, you know, you didn't say anything at all actually in your answer. It was like, but in a way of saying like, you made the person feel good, but you didn't actually say anything, and that's what politicians do. It's like, so this thing about language and how it can be used, I don't know, you seem to think a lot about that, and
it can be used a lot of different ways, right? And I think that we're language, like, you can say that it's always kind of manipulative for good or for bad. We're trying to convince each other of different things and trying to signal different things to one another all the time. I didn't know the phrase soft language before we started talking about it, and but what I had been feeling was that there are certain words, we can call them, I guess maybe we call them hard language words, that have so much baggage. They just have a tremendous amount of baggage with them for certain people. And some words will have baggage for, a word that has a lot of baggage for one person will have no baggage for the other. You told a story about how this person that you were following, he stopped saying the word pandemic.
Right.
Because he was able to see the data that people would...
They would stop watching.
Like, that's some hard data, yeah. right? That's some hard language
hard,
data.
Hard, hard language. Yeah. Yeah.
Hard data on the hard language. But there are lots of examples like that. I was telling you that if I was going to talk to someone about global warming, especially... I actually do it with people who believe in global warming, too. But especially someone who doesn't, I'm not going to use the words global warming. You say something like, it seems like the planet is getting hotter. We're not completely sure, but the scientists like data is showing that, and we don't know exactly why, but it seems like it's connected with the amount we're using oil and burning oil. I don't know. You know, things like you just can, for me, it's about sticking to the facts, actually, keeping it simple, and expressing that, yes, we don't know anything for certain.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the only way to do it, but the way I tend to do it is to be like, just give some space and qualify a little bit more that like, I could be wrong.
Yeah, because the phrase I've thought is actually, maybe you're right. You know, when you're, yeah, when you're allowing sure. space for someone else's perspective, it's like a way to just say like, yeah, okay, maybe there's a chance that what you're saying is true, and yeah. you can sort of, yeah.
Exactly, and you can say it in so many, you can say it explicitly and you can say it implicitly in a lot of ways also.
If I had to theoreticize about why you do that kind of thing, I mean, obviously you live in the United States and it's quite polarized here sometimes, so you
sure.
probably...
I have conservative family and I grew up with conservative friends.
Right.
So, and I'm not conservative. I was liberal when I was younger.
Yeah. Like, so perhaps at various points you've had to have difficult discussions and, you know, maybe you learn to like, okay, avoid saying those things because it sort of derails the discussion and it makes it hard to connect.
People are so much more complex than we often give them credit for. Like, or we know people in our lives. We have people in our lives. And we know them to be complex and complicated. That, like, they'll believe one thing and then this other thing that's completely contradictory. All yeah. of us have people in our lives that are like this.
Yeah.
But then when we talk about people we don't know, we act like they're simple. Or if we meet someone new, we treat them like they don't have all these complexities, they don't have all these contradictions.
Yeah.
But they absolutely do. Everyone does. And you're not going to know what they are unless you kind of poke around a little. And you do also have to kind of trust that you're going to be able to find some common ground or you're going to be able to agree on something with them.
Mm.
And once you find one thing, it's easier to find a second and a third. But the soft language is what allows you, like when you're poking around, the soft language is what allows you to get there and explore.
Yep.
Because you don't, it's like, I don't want to use a war metaphor. It's almost like you accidentally find a pressure point and they flinch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want that. You want them to feel comfortable the same way you want, and you always want a conversation partner to feel comfortable.
Yeah. So it sounds great the way you just said it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, maybe you find one thing and then maybe that goes to multiple
yeah.
things. Da, da, da. It's a nice
maybe answer. You don't.
It's
I want to say, like, maybe well, you don't.
Maybe you do, maybe you don't. It's a kind of happy path that you've outlined. And I believe that. I mean, I think that's kind of how I try to work anyway. I'm curious, like, where your limit is. Like, at what point are you like, I'm not going to try doing things this way anymore because it's beyond my limit, you know? And, like, how would you define that for yourself?
There's one friend in particular, or now they're, I would say, a former friend, where after many conversations, it felt to me like there was a fundamental difference and that there wasn't a lot of value in continuing to talk.
Hmm.
They were liberal when it came to United States politics, and I was liberal at the time, but it's kind of slowly discovered that they were a Hindu nationalist. I discovered that around the time that they decided that they returned to India.
Mm.
And, you know, it was disappointing to learn this about them. I don't know. I actually don't see it as a good thing that I decided to pull away. But it was something I had to do for myself, for my own kind of peace, I don't know, or my own comfort, yeah, I don't actually don't really think like, wow, that was a great choice, mm-hmm. but it was the one I felt like I had to make at the time because yeah. it was causing me too much grief and pain to continue talking to them about this and trying to move past these some key disagreements. I felt that they weren't seeing or respecting anymore the dignity of an entire group of people, and we weren't in each other's lives anymore other than talking. Mm. And we really didn't talk about anything else, you know. And so at a certain point, I think I got tired.
Yeah,
really. I ran out of energy for it and pulled away. But I don't have any hard and fast rule about when I would pull away.
Yeah, you'll know. You'll feel it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what you're saying now is sort of reminding me of something that I think about often, and I'm still not sure how I articulate this for myself. That you can't really blame someone for their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's
mm-hmm.
a simple way to say it. Like,
yeah.
You know, you disagree with something that someone says or something that they believe, and maybe it's kind of, you consider it discrimination or just untruthful or wrong or whatever, and there's a tendency to, like, we remove that person or there's some issue in the relationship because of that. There's something uncomfortable about being in proximity with someone who is holding on to something you find uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people should take care of themselves to not suffer in that way if that is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of changing the way people think and helping things progress and move into a different direction, I think there has to be some compassion mm-hmm. around the fact that people have not always chosen their beliefs, and as a result of the circumstances that they've been in, they're not able to actually see something else, and you can't just simply say to them, well, actually, that's not true, or that's wrong,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the scientists say differently. Science might not be a thing that they understand, or they
trust.
It's legitimate trust, exactly. So there's an interesting, interesting challenge there, I find, like, where you're trying to actually, first of all, separate the belief from the person. Like, don't just write the person off because they mm-hmm. believe X. And then, how can you approach them in a way that makes them feel human, right? And I think the soft language is part of that. Being more patient within your limits is part of that. But
bring cookies
be a nice person generally. I don't know, I, like, it's just something I think about. I don't really have a kind of an answer to that or something,
course.
But it's just something I'm thinking about.
Wondering
how you feel about that.
I don't know if this is right or wrong, but the more power and agency someone has, the more I kind of question, the less grace I give to them. So Rupert Murdoch gets less grace than my grandpa.
Mm. Because more should be expected because he has more power and agency.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I'm not completely sure that's right, because I do have this fundamental belief that every single person is shaped by their environment, and Rupert was shaped by all these mm-hmm. things that mm-hmm. happened to him. So but at the same time, I have this sense that he chose a less moral path, and there was something willful about it. His options were much wider than my grandfather's, the ones in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tension. It's like, actually, it's definitely a contradiction of mine, is like a feeling that he could or should do more without believing that he actually would.
Hmm.
Because he was just being shaped by what was around him. So, yeah, but it's at the same time, I know I have choices in front of me. You know, we don't need to talk about free will. That's a whole. let's avoid that one. But I think I do tend to give more space to someone who has less power.
I was just sweet talking your ability to
yeah.
just speak so fluidly, and it was too much. I'm sorry. It was too much. I just like how you talk, you know, and I really do attribute it to music. I think, like, because you've studied music, like, this is something kind of rare, I guess, that I don't meet people that have studied music in a similar way to me, and you did classical music.
We both studied
in
college.
Yeah, so I think that's cool anyway. And I want to think that that informs how you speak, but you're saying it's not that.
No, what I said was, and this is all I said before we started recording, I listened to my dad give a speech every week. 20 minutes a week, he'd give a speech, he'd do public speaking. Not just to me, because my dad was a pastor.
Oh, in the church.
My dad's a Christian pastor.
Oh, man.
He's only recently retired. I don't know how much I can attribute to that, but I'm very familiar with some of the patterns of speaking. I listen to him put the words together, make an argument, and talk about how you should live, and talk about how you should be.
Right.
With certain rhythms and patterns, and it's maybe a bit easier for me to just settle into that type of speak. He and I have some of the same mannerisms, too.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah.
It's dangerous.
It's totally dangerous.
Because you're like kind of, it's kind of persuasive. I mean, I don't feel like you're trying to persuade me or anybody, actually. Yeah. You're quite like, you know, this is how I think about things. Mm-hmm. And like, you're not trying to sell anything. And perhaps your father wasn't either. But there is something about like when you're giving a speech and you're sort of, I guess, telling people how to live or like giving them advice or some mm-hmm. kind of, I think the word they use is like teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's in these sermons, it's a kind of teaching or anyway.
It is teaching. Yeah.
So there is an element of like you're trying to, you know, maybe speak confidently or have credibility or like.
Yeah.
and of course, these people, they are just people. They have families and they're human and everything. But they are very particularly like acutely experienced in this thing about every week you give a speech and people listen and you hopefully try to sound convincing and like it's I think that's super interesting to just grow up in that and, like that's your father, like your father does that and you genetically perhaps get some of that or just through experience with him you get some of that and like you kind of have this way of speaking which for me is like I want to keep listening somehow.
Mm.
I don't know what that is, but
well, that's
I think
nice
that's
cool. To say.
Yeah.
I do try and just say like what's true for me, and that's something that I didn't learn from my father. I learned somewhere else. I learned from being in lots of activist spaces, being in lots of leftist spaces, where that's often one of the ground rules when you enter into a training. Speak from your own
experience.
You know, it's a classic, and it's a classic for a reason. But I think that other people's experiences can be instructive.
Mm.
So, including mine. Not particularly mine, but including mine.
Yeah. So I had written down some things
in
Berlin, and I have no idea what these mean anymore.
I'm sure I don't either, but let's try.
First one is, the hole gets bigger.
The hole gets bigger. Could it have been about income and expenses?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. Something I like to say when I talk to friends about money, because I've been making more and more money. I used to make $34,000 a year, and now I make $89,000 a year. Yeah, that's almost three times as much, and I'm living in the same place, and it's only been 5 years. So I'm making maybe more than you'd expect a nonprofit person to make now. I was certainly making less than you would expect a full-time working nonprofit person to make in New York to make then. But what I say is as the income goes up, the expenses go up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are rich people stressed? Why are they stressed? They should not be stressed about anything. But as the income goes up, the expenses go up. And perhaps this is when I said, the hole gets bigger. You keep throwing things in the hole and you think it's going to fill up, but the hole just gets bigger. I don't know. That's my best guess.
The need gets bigger.
The needs expand. The cars get nicer. The apartments get bigger. The apartments multiply if you're like really making a lot of money, which is ridiculous. The water bottles get nicer. The clothing gets a little bit nicer. It looks the same, by the way, but it gets nicer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to think that if I was really wealthy, that nobody would know.
Yeah.
And that I would just wear exactly what I'm wearing now, that the hole would not get bigger, or that I would just look the same. I would have a different number in my bank account or something. But perhaps that's naive.
Well, I think people do that, but you'd definitely spend more than you spend now. I think you can pull it off, but I don't know, some trip that you've been wanting to go on for a long time, it becomes just possible to do it.
Yeah.
And you just do it. It's like, why would I not do it? This thing that's not even a bad thing. I'm not even hurting anyone. Mm-hmm. My kid wants to learn piano, and instead of searching for the cheapest possible piano teacher, I'm finding a good one because I want them to have a good piano teacher. And instead of skimping around trying to like maybe do every other week and then maybe like a workbook the off weeks, it's every week. And this is how you're actually spending on these things like two or three times as much money without thinking about the fact that you're doing it, because you're not measuring money the same way as you were before. And I think people are less stressed out actually when they get more money. It does make life easier because it's one thing that you have to think about less, but it doesn't completely disappear. The hole does get bigger.
Have you heard the phrase, money makes you more of who you are?
Well, no. Money makes you more of who you are. And we're all terrible.
Well, that settles that one. Right, thank you. I guess in some sense, I hope that's a way of saying what I said before, where I hope I would be the same. And so, but I totally see what you're saying. And it's something I never thought about this, like, if you have more, it's like, of course you'll spend more. Like, it's actually kind of guaranteed. Or maybe you have to spend more. And I think of so many things where, like, it can even just be a little thing. Like, oh, that costs like $10 more. Maybe I wouldn't have normally gone for that. And now it's like, oh, well, I guess I'll just do that. And so you're almost guaranteed to spend more, actually. So, yeah, curious.
It's true that, like, there's some threshold where you really can choose to maintain a good life without, and like choose to kind of not act like you're super rich. There's a story of a teacher that had a bunch of money from something and no one knew, and then everyone finds out, like in this case he didn't have kids and there was a big donation of all of his money when he died. So that's how everyone finds out that that's the only time when people found out that he had all this money, right? Yeah. And he was still driving his little broken down Toyota Corolla.
Nice.
Right. So there are stories like this. I don't. Of course, there are exceptions, but yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Next one.
Yeah.
Baking to create connections.
Oh. I was really into that last year, and I still love baking, and I still love making connections. Still love making connections, and I still love eating cookies, but less so this year. But what I would do. Last year, I moved to a new place, and I had been gone from New York, where I live, for like 6 months, basically. And before that, it was the pandemic, so it's just kind of, I really wanted to find ways to connect with people. And what I would do is make something, and then text the people who I knew around me and say, hey, do you want some banana bread?
So you just bake?
Like, I would bake something.
You bake too much.
Yeah.
And then call people up and say, hey, do you want
this? I've got too much. I would say that. Like, I've got some extra. So there's absolutely no, like, feeling on their end, that like, taking something from
not
me.
Not do you
it's
want
like,
a piece, but do you want
no, it's like, I have too much, and I want to give it to you. I can bring it to you.
Yeah.
I'll take it to your house. And, of course, for me, I actually just want to go see them. Spend a little bit of time with them. Because it's a tradition that I'm familiar with, like where I grew up, the neighbor just brings something over, but you don't just take it from them at the doorstep and they leave. No, you invite them in, they sit down in the entryway, the living room, whatever it is, and you chat a bit, and then eventually they leave.
Yeah.
And this is the type of thing I was seeking to try to kind of like solidify or strengthen, cultivate some of the connections that I had that were in my neighborhood that were weaker at the time.
And you, because what you're talking about there is kind of like a small town thing, I guess, where people show up and it's spontaneous and you just invite them. And that's like in a city, so you mentioned neighborhood here. So you're living in a city, which maybe is harder. It's harder to do that kind of thing. And maybe you focus on your neighborhood and just people who are around, or
I did focus on my neighborhood. Yeah. I focused on people I could walk to. It's five people, you know, it's not that many, but five is enough. And they did invite me in and we did hang out. One of them, they offered me something back, like some food. And another time, I remember I borrowed a book of poetry from them that we had a conversation. They thought it would be, you know, I took that home with me, and then, you know, it's just like just a way to catalyze something.
I totally love it. I'm so glad you remember that, because I actually, in addition to not remembering what I wrote, I forgot about that you told me that, and I think that's great. I must have written it down, because I'm like, oh, I'd actually would like to do that someday, because that sounds cool, and like now I have this reminder.
Yeah.
And hopefully other people have a prompt as well, because I think it's just a beautiful thing, and I would love for also more people to just
come. Well, the baking is fun too, you know, and the eating of the sweets yourself. Also fun. There's like no bad parts to this. There's no negative side effects to this, except maybe you have too many sweets, which is depends on how you feel about sweets, I guess.
Exactly.
And if you you know, also you share, I shared it a little bit with my roommates. Like, there's like plenty, you know, I can share with friends and roommates, and then still have like several days worth for myself.
Yeah, cooking food generally is an underrated way of just connecting, bringing people together, having connections. Mm-hmm. Something I wish I was more comfortable with. Like, I know people that are just like, yeah, I love to cook and invite people over. I love to cook and like, so I wish I was more like that, and I want.
But just today, you made your come on, you're like, I'm so bad at this. I never do this. But then just today, like 3 hours ago, you made your so-called poor man's risotto, which is based on oatmeal, and it was you, me, and you invited all of my roommates to have some.
Right, yeah.
And the roommates came into the space, one while you were cooking, the other two while in order to eat, and we socialized. Us as roommates, we're not always coming together all the time. You know, we do kind of like come and go, or we'll be in our own spaces, but your food brought everyone together for a moment there.
Well, I appreciate the reminder. I do maybe have some short-term memory issues. So,
I forgot about all do. We all do. Well, and we're all critical of ourselves. Sure. Always, of course. Yeah. You know, we're our most, you know, staunch critics. But
yeah. Anyway, totally.
It was also very tasty, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Love cranberries. We were talking yesterday, and you talked about how you had a mutual friend with someone, and who had passed, but you had more information about what had happened. You had video of the celebration of their life, and you were able to process and move through it in a way that the other person wasn't.
Because they didn't have the information.
They didn't have the video. They didn't have the experience. But you were able to pass that to them, and then they got a lot out of it. You know, they were able to really move through it, and accept it in a different way, perhaps, than they had been able to before, because they had so many questions. It's impossible to accept something that you don't know, you don't understand. Mm-hmm. I thought that was so beautiful. I don't know, I thinking about death, and, it was something that I think it must have been hard for them, even if they had if it had scabbed over in a way, you know, since it's in the years past, but like for them to be able to really kind of heal as a result of what you gave them, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. My surprise there. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful aspects to that, and I appreciate also the way you just condensed it. It's great. It's nice to actually hear somebody else say that story. And I think them getting closure through me in this sort of unexpected way is beautiful. And I was also quite preoccupied with how I had thought it was quite random that I would be there.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a little bit more baffled by that for some reason. It's like, oh, I thought I was just, you know, I had a contact in the city that was a friend of somebody, and I'd just say hello and like hang out, have a coffee or something. And it became this hyper meaningful thing. And the word that somebody, this person, the phrase that someone says is, you are my closure. And to go from just a random, like, oh, let's just hang out with this person and see what happens, to like, this has helped them in the way that you described, to find healing, and yeah, like just revisit an old wound and find solace and comfort and closure and feel good knowing that their friend was surrounded by other friends and people that they were cared about, and they had a beautiful celebration and all these things. Like, yeah, it's just interesting to have no just how unexpected that was for me is it just makes me question what do I think I'm doing, actually? Like, am I doing this? Like, is it me? Really? Like, it's such a coincidence. I shared this with the person who I was staying with at the time, and he's like, because I was trying to downplay the, I was like, oh, I don't want to talk about this in any kind of spiritual way or something. Mm-hmm. He's like, you'd be crazy to not do that, you know, or like, what would it take for someone to, like, I mean, why do people, even at this level, they would refuse to see it that way? And I don't mean to argue to see it in a spiritual way. It's just like the, and whatever spiritual even means, I don't know. It's just like, how do you make sense of something like that? Yeah. Like, you just say that's random, I guess, or like,
well, there was a relationship. Yeah. And what I see is, and I've seen this in other areas too, but like, it's just an openness from you.
Yeah.
Like a tremendous openness from you.
Yeah.
We've only met in person twice.
Yeah.
You and I. But you are tremendously open to like engaging with people that you know, like at this level, and you, that openness also leads to like depth, the depth of our conversations, you know, it's deeper than conversations I've had with people I've talked to 15 times.
Mm.
Right. And it's because you're so open and, you take a chance and you say like, oh, this person, you say like, I don't know what's going to happen when I meet this friend of a friend, but I'm open to whatever happens. And sometimes it's dramatic like this.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's deep, it's dramatic. Sometimes it is just coffee. Sometimes it is just coffee.
Right.
But sometimes, but you don't set boundaries and like really tight restrictions on what's going to happen.
I'm open.
You're open.
Yeah,
you let it flow.
Yeah.
So I think that's really special.
Yeah, I think to something else I was just saying now, like, we were just talking about connection, I think, I was talking about myself, I forget. So I was just saying, like, I really enjoy connection. And
during
I like,
our break.
Yeah, I like when we were just resting, it was, and I had said at the end of just describing how, like, yeah, I have this, like, serendipity network, and I like meeting people, and it's easy for me to come to them so that it's a bit, it facilitates the encounter, etc. And then I said, like, a kind of kryptonite for me is a tepid connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that one, not consequence, but like something that happens sometimes when I do open myself to these things is, it's just kind of like, okay, mm-hmm. we had coffee and it was like cool and, or maybe sort of not, and like, and I'm just like, and I feel uncomfortable when it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I feel like I'm really biased towards like, oh, it has to be like, has to change your life. Mm-hmm. I use that phrase all the time in some sense, and perhaps that's what just happened, and somehow I'm like surprised by that, even though that's what I'm looking for. So there's a confluence of all these weird expectations and hopes, and I'm not sure what else there's to say about that. When I ask you about it, it's more that, similar to how I was saying you seem comfortable with talking about emotions, it's like you have this way of processing or talking about either death that had already happened, or in the case that when we had met, what was about to happen to a relative of yours, and like you were just kind of neutral, and not in a how do you say?
Well, I wasn't, you know, it was actually quite emotional for me,
right,
but I guess I was able to talk. I just spoke about it in simple terms.
Yeah, like, it's like you're able to speak about it from a point of view, like, somewhat detached from your emotions. Like, you're not detached from the person, but from your emotion, right? And you can talk about the emotion that you're experiencing and sort of look at it, like, as it's on a screen and just tell a story about it or share, you know? And, I just find that interesting and a topic like this also. And I just wondered if you'd had any kind of... I always want to ask, like, you know, why are you able to do that?
Of course, I don't really know.
What's your secret?
But having many opportunities to share. I've been asked a lot. I've been lucky to be in many situations where I'm asked to speak about my emotions.
Okay.
And a lot of people aren't in that situation very often. Mm. They're in situations, they're never asked how they feel. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? And I've been lucky to be in places that do. So maybe there's a certain learning through repetition. Actually, for better or for worse, it's often in a kind of a situation where I'm trying to also maintain some sort of professional reputation. And so actually feeling those emotions and taking up space with those emotions is not something like I'm trying to do in some of these situations. Like, sometimes it's actually very good to be not detached and very much within them. I think that can be very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But in a conversation...
You said not detached.
Yeah, not detached.
Yeah.
To feel them. It's very good to feel them. You have to feel them. And if you don't feel them, if you're only detached, it's, you know, I actually think that's not necessarily a good thing. But I think there's also something nice about being able to talk about them from a little bit of a distance.
Where can people find out more about you?
I have a website. It's hew.tt.
hew.tt.
And my last name is Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, but I have...
I don't know that one.
I went to the Trinidad and Tobago domain registrar, and I purchased hew.tt.
All right.
And if you want to just go straight to the writing, there's not like a ton of writing. I'm constantly beating myself up a little bit over how little writing there is. But you can go to notebook.hew.tt.
All right.
That's the kind of the personal website, really.
Amazing. I will check some of those out myself. And great to chat with you, Nathan. Thanks
great
for being here.
Great to chat with you. Yeah.
That was my extended conversation with Nathan Hewitt on strolling. If you enjoyed that, you might like my exchange with Mariama Diallo, who applies her methods of self-care to social media, or with Jessica Alonso for her deep explorations on relationships and technology, or with Doug Webb, who has figured out many things about cooperation and self-governance. Find all this and more at strolling.rosano.ca. That's strolling.rosano.ca. See you next time, and thanks for listening.